as opposed to an omnidirectional pattern. So the only reason why they want you less than a tenth is to keep it omnidirectional. And even if it was omnidirectional, you now have to worry about whether the feed point is at 12 o'clock, 9 o'clock, 3 o'clock, or 6 o'clock on the loop. You'd have to favor the feed point into the direction you're transmitting. By keeping the loop a tenth of a wavelength, and it's therefore omnidirectional, you don't have to worry about where you feed it. That's what I think is going on. There's nothing magic about keeping it under a tenth of a wavelength, as long as you recognize where the peak and the valley of the transmitted wave is. Back of the pattern. Back to you, Mel.
Roger. Well, they call it, you know, the split shield type of antenna. In other words, up at the second base, where you poke the shield up, you cut the shield at that point, approximately 1 inch at the corner of the frame at second base, and so you got the shield split at that point, and the variable condenser I'm using on it, basically, you could get away with a broadcast variable capacitor, just for receiving one of those 365 PF full variables. I happen to have a regular variable that was a transmitter, that's a surplus capacitor, goes from about 30 to 390, I think it is. So that's basically, as well as the mounted on there, I just made a little mounting bracket for it that mounts right on a wooden frame and all. So you can easily, tune it, adjust it. It's very critical, of course. You can't move off frequency at all without, and the peak is it's very sharp, very pronounced when it peaks that signal. But it's sure, I can say, with a two multiplier and all, it's fantastic job. Unless you sit there and actually play with it, and in fact, what the most interesting is that when you look at the scope, I have the pan scope that's on the column A4, and just the noise, and you can see the noise score as you adjust the second movement, and you manipulate everything. You actually watch how you bring down the noise score and watch the peak of the tip, just to see the tip peak. And with enough manipulation, usually I get off 5 minutes late because I'm playing, the guys are on already on Pennsylvania. They're talking to each other, and I take me a few minutes to get the whole thing manipulated. If somebody comes on another direction or something like that, many times I don't quite hear. In other words, there's no simple method without playing with turning, twisting, adjusting variables, and then playing with the QRN squasher box with the two controls on that. You're busy like a one-arm bandit over.
Yeah, but what a fun thing to tune that, where you've got those three variables involved, as, L, and polarization. And once you peak them up, you're peaking for the best signal and or best signal-to-noise ratio, lowest noise, highest signal. And my guess is just by listening with your earphones, so to speak, you know when you hit it right. Now, you tell almost any antenna engineer, you tell almost any ham radio operator that you can build a dipole or a loop at, say, a tenth of a wavelength or a twentieth of a wavelength long, and at the frequency where you resonate it, where you get rid of the reactive component, and you've matched the remaining resistive component, so you impedance match that antenna and resonate it, the fact that it's going to give you essentially the same effective capture area on reception, or the same pattern and gain on transmission, as a full half-wave dipole, even though it's a tenth or a twentieth of a wavelength long. That's the magic of resonance. You say those words to the majority of antenna engineers and the vast majority of ham radio operators, and they'll say to you, what in the world are you smoking? Are you testing my gullibility? You're giving me a story. You're creating a hoax. This is phony. It can't possibly be. The laws of physics won't let you do that. Mother Nature won't let you do that. They'll go on and on and on. They haven't understood that chapter in the the Bible on the subject, the Krauss Antenna Book, McGraw-Hill, 1950, the book called Antennas, the chapter on the infinitesimal dipole. He said it in black and white. If you know what he's reading, he said it. And his second and third edition is repeating it. I haven't read it in any other book, and that's the problem. Not many people are interested in a small dipole. Not many people are interested in a dipole, particularly not microwave operators. Therefore, they don't see that chapter, that classic book. Therefore, they don't have that information. They haven't been there. They haven't done it. It's so crazy, they never get a chance to try it and find out that it's not crazy, and therefore they don't believe. We have a huge credibility gap here. We have a huge lack of understanding, a lack of education in this extremely important area. I say it's extremely important because every human being you and I know has fallen in love with wireless hardware. They want everything to be wireless, whether it be the cordless phone, the remote operation of the garage door opener, their easy pass, their RFID identification circuits, their cell phone. In every one of these handheld wireless products, whether it's got whether it's got GPS reception, whether it's got cell phone reception, whether it's got Wi-Fi, 802.11, Bluetooth, Zigbee, call it what you like. There's zillions of services. Everybody wants an extremely small antenna in that handheld device. So in many cases, you're forced into fraction of a wavelength antenna because the real estate isn't there. Without this understanding of this concept, those antennas do not get domestically designed and produced. They're produced by outsourced companies who understand the process, who hide the antenna inside of a piece of ceramics so you don't know what's there. They call it proprietary. They make it as a fractal technique for shrinking it even further. But because of a lack of understanding, they don't know that they're buying something very simple, very common, and paying a great big royalty for it. What a waste, because of a lack of understanding. And the schools do not teach the subject. How in the world have you gone this many years downrange? I mean, Heinrich Hertz first built a Hertzian dipole antenna way back in 1860 or so. So we're 140 years downrange, and we still don't understand the most basic antenna in its extremely small form. Ain't that crazy, Mel? K2KEY. Consider going to your mailbag if you want to. K2LIW and the TechNet.
Yeah, Roger, this is K2KEY. Well, we start getting into education and all. Yes, some very great men in the past have more or less said exactly what, you know, and the people that were knowledgeable in the antenna field, such as my old good old buddy there, John Krauss, who I had the pleasure, of course, to meet, and also Walt Maxwell, W2DU, and like you say, most of this stuff is never mentioned, and because a lot of it, if it was, you have a lot of problems convincing people when they first hear this, even after a point that, I had this whole thing, last week also, just really one more and then I'm going to go on. I had a whole thing about when I mentioned to somebody last week that joined our group that, you know, he was making a statement. He said, well, you got to have an antenna tuner just to make the transceiver happy. And I said, the antenna tuner is doing something else, I says, and that is tuning the antenna. He says, what? He says, how can an antenna tuner tune the antenna? And I got involved in a whole deal, and then I said, did I make a mistake? Oh, my God, it went on and on. We wound up, I said, finally, got to give somebody else a chance on the frequency. You know, we had a group of four or five on there. He says, oh, you can't get away with that so easy. I said, listen, you go read, and I'll give you places where you can read about this. But an antenna tuner does tune the antenna, okay? And that's what I'll stand by. So the other fellows that are off frequency says, listen to Mel, he usually gives us the right information. All right, well, enough of that, Dick, unless you want to make another comment on this.
Yes, I do. What we call antenna is not just the piece of wire called antenna. We all know that if you do a lousy job of balancing, and you got a whole lot of current flowing on the outside of your coax cable, or you got common mode current flowing down your twin lead, that the feed line can also be part of the antenna. It can radiate, let me pick a number, 50% of the power. It's part of the antenna. It's controlling the efficiency, the pattern, the work, the effective capture area, the whole thing. When you get down to the bottom line, what we call antenna is just one component of a radiating system. The radiating system consists of antenna, feed line, antenna tuner, impedance matcher, final stage of the transmitter, and the transmitter final stage PI network. That combination you resonate. That combination does the radiating after it resonates. And whether or not 99% of the radiation takes place from the dipole itself, or whether it's 50-50 between the dipole and the feed line, and maybe it's 30-30-30 between dipole, feed line, and a very leaky antenna tuner. Doesn't matter. It's a radiating system, that the total system must be resonated if you want to get efficient radiation from that system. But you're resonating a radiating system. And who cares if the antenna tuner is located right at the antenna, or an inch away, or a foot away, or 100 feet away. If the feed line is low enough and lost, it's just another impedance converting device in between the antenna tuner and the antenna. It's just a more complicated impedance matching that could have been done at the antenna. Everybody will accept the fact that if the antenna tuner is located right at the antenna, it can resonate the antenna. And you mean to tell me it can't be 1 inch downrange on the feed line? 1 foot, 10 feet, 50 feet, 100 feet? Where's the threshold? Where is the number of feet downrange where the antenna tuner can no longer tune the antenna? Had we step by step asked that critic you ran into the other night that question, we could have had a grand old time with him. Back to you, Mel. Maybe it's better that we went easy with him. K2KUY, K2LAW.
Well, finally what I did is I said, listen, I want you to go, I have a couple of references. Go there and read carefully and come back and see what you have learned, because it went on and on. I mean, I'm afraid. I mean, you don't know. I wish you would join us on 75. Oh, Dick, you'd have a grand old time with these guys. They'd be on you like, as they say, like, you know, like a bunch of crazed individuals attacking this wild man we got on frequency. All right, enough of that. Let's read a couple of emails. Let me see. Got a lot of stuff on CDs and questions. Yeah, we went over this over and over. Go listen to it. I'm not going to answer no more about CDs. We did enough of that. Here's another. Oh, last week you guys discussed IF. Somebody, oh yeah, that guy called in with the IF. You remember I had the email? That was the, it was a making crackling, to locate the crackling. Yes, I found, like you did, I did that experiment, like you said, to locate the IF that was making the noise. But the problem is, I see with this IF, oh, the slug is stuck. What do I do? Is there any way to free the slug up? I tried a regular tuning wand, but I'm twisting the tuning wand and it's not moving. What can I do? Well, I can give you a couple of ideas. First, Dick, what's your idea? Over.
Yeah, the slug is usually held in with a little piece of rubber, or in some cases, it's a wax piece of tubing with the slug down it and the wire wrapped on the outside. I guess in the extreme case, you can unsolder the IF can, if it's an IF can, from the board or case that it's in, disassemble the IF can and look inside, maybe apply a heat gun to warm up the wax, maybe the rubber has deteriorated, or maybe there was some glue in there that needs to be dissolved. There's a zillion ways I can think of that the slug can become jammed, and just forcing it harder and harder with a tuning tool, you could end up just cracking the slug and then life gets complicated. You don't want to do that. If you're already applying what you think is a moderate amount of force with the tuning tool, hopefully it's a hexagonal tuning tool, and it doesn't move, then it's time to start disassembling it and find out what's jamming it. and see if you can use a solvent or heat or whatever. But you do have to move the slug. If it really is a tuning slug, you do have to move it. You got to be careful. Sometimes the slug is missing, and what you think is a slug is just a hole in the bottom of the printed circuit board at the bottom of the IF can, and you're trying to turn the board, if you know what I mean. So you got to go slow with that one so as not to damage it, because pieces of equipment that have an IF can are kind of rare these days. You don't want to damage it because replacing it may be very difficult. Back to you, Mel.
Here we go.
Hey, Rich recognized. Get to you in 1 second. Yes, what I have is basically a lot of the hex plugs, you can find an Allen key that will fit into it. Now, the iron Allen key, what you do, not to put the force on it, but you'll put the plug, I should say, and then you have to knock out pieces and replace it. Take the Allen key. I actually made a tool up that is basically a copy of the hex driver. And what I do with that, I put, in fact, a nice little knob on the top of it and all. What I did to do, I used to heat up that piece of iron, get it good and hot with a match or something. Then I pass it down into the IF can, let it sit there for a couple of, about a minute or so, and then wiggle slowly back and forth to see if the slug will come loose from heating it up internally that way, without taking the can apart and all. I made up that tool, but you could many times you find if you find a long Allen key to slip in there, you can most likely do the same thing by heating up that Allen key, getting it fairly hot, not to the point that it's going to melt everything out, but getting it hot enough that you know that you can slip it in there and it'll stuff the heat into the slug and like it sticks as many times as the wax with the dirt building up in there and everything, the combination of everything, the rubber band and all. Just glue it up, this plug. But you got to be careful with these IF cans. They're virtually impossible to replace. Go ahead, Rich, with your idea. Over.
Yeah, I was going to say something similar to what you said, Mel, with the Allen key. When I did servicing for a living, I found sometimes the slugs were already cracked by the time you got to it. When you put a plastic hexagonal tool in there, it would just slip because the cracked slug was, the pieces were being forced against the innards of the threads on the can. Sometimes putting an Allen key in there, just ever so slightly larger diameter, you can grip it, get it out. Sometimes the slug is in 2, 3, or 4 pieces, and then, replace the slug, but you got to be careful what you replace it with. You got to use something in the same that causes permeability, which is easier said than done, but I found sometimes that's what happens. It'll come out with an Allen key, but you'll find that the slug has been in there cracked for a long time. Good, Mel.
Have you ever had any luck, Rich, gluing the pieces back together, or is that essentially out of the question?
Well, you know, I never tried that, Dick, but that's a good point, because a toroid I know can break, glue it, it should work. I guess if you glue everything back and don't have any burns, it should work if it's not a million pieces.
Yeah, I think with what do they call it, crazy glue, cyanoacrylate, I think you could possibly glue the pieces back together so tightly that the permeability would be close to the same. Because to try to find a slug of the same material and the same size and the same thread, that could be kind of difficult. Although I'll bet you if I know Mel, he's probably got in one corner of his basement, he's got a shelf devoted to IF cans. Every IF can that's ever been made by mankind, he's got a copy of it, and he's even got some spare slugs for him. That's a pure guess on my part. Is that true, Mel? Go ahead.
Exactly. You know, they have kits. I have drawers. That with the different IF cans, they used to have these, that put out that kit. I'm trying to remember. There was a company that actually made that with little drawers in each one. I have different IF cans in it. And, yeah, like Rich said, you can then sometimes just take the pieces out. But, of course, most likely when you pull the piece out, it's going to be in so many pieces, I doubt if you're ever going to get it together in a form that the threads and all are going to be, you know, lined up to be able to screw back in. And, you know, if it's just foot and two, you get, you flip it out. Any, but many times when it's, you know, busted up like that, the idea is you want to get the pieces out. So sometimes even putting, working a drill bit in, you know, by hand and breaking it up in more pieces and then just shaking out what's left, you know, make the salvage the core itself, the plug, is most likely easy to replace. I have a whole lot of them, Dick. You got to go, like you say, light-handed on these things because they're not off the shelf. Only I have off the shelf. I got that. I got also drawers to make up switches. You name it. You know, assemble different wafer switches. They used to have all these different things, you know, in these shops and all, and they were dumping all this. And of course, I couldn't let that stuff go in the dump. Over.
No, that slug kit, could that have been like J.W. Miller who put that out?
Yeah, it was Miller most likely. I don't remember. I'd have to take a look. I don't think it was Miller. What was the name of that other company? They were very famous in making IF cans that they put out that those kits. You know, I can picture it. I can picture the box and all. They made, the yellow label on it is not Miller. Who the heck was the other one, over?
Okay, in modern day it would be Murata, but that's a red label. In the old days, I wonder if it was Tencor. Also, when it comes to a rotary switch kit, I'll bet you owned one of those great big metal cabinets, Oak, O-A-K. The Oak company made a switch kit where you could choose the detent mechanism, the rod length, the number of wafers, the number of poles, and whatever. I bet you own one of those Oak kit rotary switch kits. Is that true, Mel? Go ahead.
I'm sure. That's exactly what I have. You have the spaces, you have the long screws to put it together. You have the plates to go in the back if you want to add it. They have switches, all kinds of switches, double poles, single poles, switches, double switches that you can put on these different plates. And the shaft length, you cut the shaft length down. You have long shaft length, and you cut it. You made as many, you know, wafer switches and arrangements that you wanted. So that was replacement. But a lot of those different things those days had, of course, wafer switches in that would burn up, break off, whatever. They used to have all these kits. And, you know, you really did repairs in those days. You know, you didn't pull something out and say, oh, look at this, with all these components on it. I'm not going to look for the one component. Throw it in the garbage now. Those days, you did repairs, like you say, Dick, or whatever it needed. You replaced. You took tuners. I got a whole thing with tuners. Oh, but you don't know what I've got for rebuilding tuners of all kinds. All those wafers and parts that go in slugs and the fine-tuning of pieces and everything and detents, all for just for repairing tuners, Dick, over.
You're telling me you could replace the wafer switch on an RCA 630 tuner or the individual coils of a Philco turret tuner 1948 television set? You mean to tell me you go back that far, Mel?
Exactly. It's so full funny. I might pull out the shaft and then take the wafers, sometimes the piece in the middle, you know, where the shaft turns, breaks. I used to put in the whole wafer, no doubt. I used to repair also the Dumont tuners. That was a tuner wide as brakes. If you bumped into it, like you went and you moved your chair over and you smacked that first, the shaft that stuck out with that knob, you know, with the spinner. You remember they had on there, they had that, what the heck was the name of the Mallory rotary tuner on that. There we are, back to a rotary inductor. But they had a porcelain shaft that went back and it had these little rotaries on there with these little, just basically like a rotary inductor, but three of them. If you hit that shaft in the front and weren't careful, the guys would pull the set out. How many of them came in, said, oh, they put it in the truck and all, hit that shaft in the front there, the knob, that protruded way out, broke that porcelain shaft. Now you take that tuner apart with the bearings out, oh, and everything, and put another porcelain shaft in. I got that too, Dick, over.
Wow. You're telling me you have spare porcelain shafts for a Mallory induct tuner? Is that what you're telling me you got?
Exactly. I used to fix so many of them, Dick.
Oh,
gee, that was all common. Really common they used to break them. And of course, you know, DuBont only used that. That for all the years that they were in the television business, the original DuBont company from 46 on, always had that Mallory inductor tuner. Great. It worked real great. Nice. You can go to FM on it. You can get 2 meters on it. You can get 6 meters on it. You know, so you had the switch in the front of the set that said, you know, TV or FM. You know, you flip that switch or off, you know, with that three-position switch in the front. And so you flip it, you know, just to FM, and it had the tuning eye on it. And that was great receiver, Dick, over.
Fantastic. Is it true, or is it my faulty memory, that DuMont was part of the DuMont Network, which was Channel 5 locally in New York City? And I think it was back in the days when Channel 5 used to have Captain Video. It was the main program I can remember on Channel 5. I wonder what year, if I'm correct, what year did DuMont stop their association with local Channel 5? Was it around 1960 or so? Back to you, Mel.
I don't recall. You're talking about WAED. That was Channel 5. Now on the DuMont Network out of New Jersey. When did he stop? DuMont Labs, if you remember, DuMont had quite an operation at one time. They had the DuMont, of course, television network. Then there was DuMont Laboratories, and then DuMont Manufacturing portion of it. Little or nothing is known by a lot of people that DuMont was very big in the manufacture of instruments, especially specializing in the 40s in oscilloscopes, over.
I owned the DuMont oscilloscope. Also, another great big research lab at one time was the CBS lab. I'm not sure where they were located, but I know it was a big fancy setup at one time. Go ahead.
Nick?
Yeah, go ahead.
What happened to the Bell, Bell Labs, the Bell breakup? Is that still in existence, I hope, Bell Labs?
Some of the main buildings, like Whippany, and trying to think of the name of the one in New Jersey that has the great big Hoghorn antenna that was used by Penzias and Wilson to make the first radio astronomy measurement of the black body noise. Can't think of the name of the Holmdel Laboratory, empty building. Whippany is probably an empty building. When the Bell Laboratories got broken up and a little piece of it became loosened, and the baby bells, ITT and whatever, got all broken up. An awful lot of that is empty buildings. An awful lot of that capability and those smart people are essentially gone, as far as I can tell. Rich, go ahead.
Okay, that's a shame, because they developed the first transistor, didn't they?
Yes, they did. 1947. Shockley, Bratton, and Bourdin were the three Bell Lab engineers, 1947, that made the first transistor, and I think it was a germanium, but I'm not positive of that. You see a picture of it. It's an ugly-looking thing. It's a piece of solid-state material with a bunch of paper clips poking into it. I think it had a gain of 1.5 dB and a frequency response that went to about 10 kilohertz, but that was the first transistor. I can remember my father was taking a course from the National NRL, National Research Laboratory. There was a mail-order course that you could take from a Washington company that would teach you electronics. And I remember when the transistor came out, there was a special little pamphlet they came out with explaining the transistor in 1948 and what the importance was going to be. It took another 10 years for transistors to really catch on, but boy, did they have a shaky beginning. And it was a re-beginning. Apparently, transistors could have been invented a lot earlier if the vacuum tube hadn't come along, which really made everybody think that the transistor solid-state devices are only good for diodes. The fact you could get gain out of a solid-state device was considered crazy. If you wanted gain, you needed a vacuum tube. that 1947, or is that first transistor? Homely looking thing. And boy, point contact transistors dominated for the next 10 years until finally people found much better ways of constructing them. I don't know who gets it, either Rich or Mel, whoever wants to pick up first, K2LIW.
All right, I don't hear Mel in there. Interesting. You know, there was a lot of technical information pointed at hand in the 50s, 60s. Don't see today, for instance, iMac and the amplifier that you're familiar with, Dick, the Moonbounce by W6PO. I wonder if any of you guys remember those kids. Early 60s, there was a newsletter produced by RCA. I believe it was in New Jersey at their receiving tube laboratory called, I think it was called Ham Notes. It was about $2 a year to get that. Do you remember that, Dick?
Yes, I do. First of all, you had the Bell System Technical Journal, which I think came out every single month. RCA had their equivalent, I don't know what it was called, but Mel's going to tell us. RCA had their monthly journal. And yes, there was a special version of the RCA journal that was dedicated toward ham. It tells you how to make best use of some of RCA's best dual-gate FET transistors and things like this. Bell Labs didn't do that. iMac certainly did. iMac had a bunch of articles dedicated to hams, particularly to the Moonbounce ham. I guess it was, can't think of the guy's name right now, an iMac engineer who published a whole lot of Moonbounce notes, and the closest thing to Moonbounce notes from Bell Laboratories was done by Dr. Dick Turin, W2IMU, the EME newsletter, and there was about 20 of those technical copies that he came out with once a month, and he distributed them to the really serious Moonbounce operators, and he eventually bound them up and published it as a self-published book of a kind, which I've got a copy of, and he sold it for $20. A lot of very good information in there. So, without a doubt, the smart people at Bell Labs and RCA and iMac were realizing that the serious RF people tended to be ham radio operators. Therefore, they tended to favor them with technical notes, and if you got a hold of the right guy at iMac, they would ship you tubes free of charge for experimental purposes. Some of their best high-power external anode ceramic tubes. Tubes like 4CX250Rs and 8877 and things like that. Those tubes were available for very desirable prices and sometimes free if you were a sufficiently prolific, well-recognized VHF, UHF, ham radio operator. Back to you, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW in the group.
Roger. Yeah, iMac was a great company. They had a deal when they came out with the 3CX800 that if for ham use, if you bought one with the chimney and socket, they sold you another one for half price. And so I bought one pair, built an amplifier with it that was featured in Ham Radio magazine, and then I was able to obtain another pair using another friend's call at the time. This was only one per call, and I built another. I used it on another amplifier. So it was a great, great tube, and the price was right. Now, God almighty, what it would cost you to replace those tubes that I got in there, those 3CX800s. I think it's more than a week's pay for sure. And you mentioned CBS. Yeah, CBS Lab was doing a lot of work, early work. In fact, I had one of the CBS color wheels. I had one of the first color TVs, which used a CBS color wheel. That's a whole nother contraption. And the ham notes by RCA were from Harrison, New Jersey, Dick, over.
How about that? The color wheel television set, in its day, although it had flicker to it, I think was the purest color you could get, because they had great trouble producing phosphors that gave you the right magnitude and the right color of red. Red was a real problem to them in the early days, and the color wheel got around that problem very nicely. But it was a large mechanical spinning thing that made noise and whatever. Synchronizing it was a little bit of a problem. We've come a long way with color cameras. When you go to that play that's in New York City right now called the Farnsworth Experiment, which talks about Philo T. Farnsworth and what he went through with his battles with Armstrong from RCA. Why can't I think of his name right now, the full name of Armstrong? Anyhow,
Sarnoff.
Sarnoff, yes. David Sarnoff, you're right. Armstrong was the guy who invented SM. I got him. David Sarnoff is the guy who really did him in something terrible. And that's pretty nicely indicated in that play. So here we are, a zillion years downrange from the essential invention of the television, which was in the 1915 or so. He, as a teenager, explained it to his physics/chemistry teacher in his high school, which I think was in Utah, where he was living at the time. And he had the right idea, but the photo detectors were very insensitive. His first early cameras had to have intense light in order to make a picture. And Dworkin was also working on that. Dworkin was with RCA at the time. Where was I going with this? I was going to ask you a question. Can't think of it right now, so I better send it back to you while I try to remember what the question was. You got it, Mel.
Comment, IZO.
Mr. IZO, start off with your name and then your comment, sir.
No, my name is Tony, and of course, N2IZO. The color wheel is alive and well. All DLP TVs use it.
Okay, which TV uses that, Tony?
DLP.
Okay, I'm not familiar with DLP. Victor Mima Papa. Is that a popular brand of TV set? Is it a small television that really has a color wheel built inside? Go ahead.
Delta Lima Papa.
Okay. Okay, and now I know what you're talking about. The DLP, kind of a display device, isn't a color wheel. It's a whole bunch of little typical devices that make red, green, and blue, and it projects it onto a screen. And it's a very effective way of building color. That's what you're referring to. Is that true, Tony?
I work in a Hitachi, and there's an actual color wheel in there. And the motor went bad. We had to replace the module.
So you're telling me it's not a whole bunch of little typical pixels. It is really a color wheel with a motor inside of the DLP device. Okay, there must be three of them in there in order to avoid the flicker. If you really had alternate frames of red, green, and blue, you'd have 20 cycles per second of flicker, and the average watcher wouldn't tolerate that. Back to you, Tony.
There was only one module. See, the mirrors themselves, that's one unit. The actual color is made by the DLP wheel, and the separate unit. There was only one color wheel.
Okay. If the color wheel is at one instant producing red, another instant producing green, another instant producing blue, how do you get around the fact that you've now got one-third the number of complete color frames, which is going to give you 20 cycles of flicker? Go ahead.
Well, they were doubled. There wasn't three of them. There was at least six, possibly more. You know, RGB, RGB repeated.
Right.
That makes more sense. Okay. Is that a currently manufactured device, or is that a laboratory curiosity?
Of the DLP TV. Hitachi, I believe it was. If you give me a little while, I can get the model number.
Okay. I bet you've seen one of these, Mel, in a store, local to you. Back to you, Mel.
No, I've not seen that one, but it's based on the CBS color wheel. Had two reds, two greens, and two blues to get around that flicker problem. 3 foot in diameter. Now, the first color moon pictures that was sent back from the moon by the camera that, who the heck made that camera for, you know, for the astronauts for the Apollo, when they had the color camera, had a color wheel in that camera. That was the only camera that was a color camera that was available at the time had that system with that little little color wheel with the two reds, two greens, and two blues, Dick, over.
Yeah, the very first pictures on Apollo 11 were black and white, monochrome. Then it was Mr. Bert Soltoff working for RCA Astro, who produced the first color camera, which I think was put on either Apollo 12 or Apollo 14. And, wait a minute now. Let's see, Apollo 12, I think, burned out the camera by aiming at the sun by mistake. I think it was a Vidicon camera. And then the later camera could tolerate being aimed at the sun. And it was Bert Soltoff, K3IUV, who produced that camera. Back to you, Mel.
Roger, and he used a color wheel in there to send back the color pictures. That was a mini color wheel. Now, I know that DLP, one of them, had that module in there. The others, I looked at the color projected that, you know, sit on the table and project onto a screen or actually project them on the wall. But it had this thin film type of transparency driven by a projection lamp, a xenon projection lamp. I've had a couple of those apart. Usually what the problem is xenon lamps circuit, you know, the high voltage that's required to run those xenon lamps, those projection lamps, go bad. But I looked at how they produced the picture through the transparency, and it basically looked like some kind of a chemical reaction. I didn't see one with a wheel, Dick, over.
Yeah, I haven't seen wheel either, but I know that some of the DLP devices have a whole bunch of individual pixels where there's a mirror-like device in front of the pixel that is tiltable under electronic control. And I thought that's the way it generates the individual pixels of the picture. But maybe Tony's got some further information on that.
If you type into Google, color wheel DLP, I'm looking through it now.
Okay, that's a good thing for us to search down. And color projection. And nowadays you can buy projection devices that you connect to your laptop, which in a meeting will give you some beautiful displays on a screen, and you can light up a whole audience of, you know, a room with 50 people, and enough brightness you don't have to turn down the light, nice high-resolution picture. We've come a long way when it comes to video display devices. The old-fashioned technique of using viewgraphs are pretty much passé. These 8x10 viewgraph slides, that's almost never used anymore compared to modern-day display devices connected to a laptop. And so that's an awful lot of the conferences I see these days. Back to you, Mel, and want to read another piece of mail? It's up to you.
Roger, I must try to get a couple more, and I have to usually answer a number of them on, because I've been piled up here a little bit. I try to be nice enough to, you know, help out whatever I can, but I got to keep it in the realm of ham radio, please. I don't want beasts. I'm not going to sit there and try to, you know, do somebody's doctorate or something, you know, that they have here to review it and all. We're not in that type of business. So if you have a question on ham radio and all, that's what I'm reading over right now. Oh, here's one. You once mentioned a simple way of measuring the Q of a small coil like a choke. I have a number of them, and I'd like to know, how do you do a simple Q measurement without a simple instrument? I do have a signal generator. I have a VTVM. I have a couple other instruments like that, but I haven't got anything to, you know, sophisticated to directly measure Q. How can I do that? Well, you can do it with a signal generator and a VTVM. All right. First of all, let Dick make his comment on it. I'll tell you how I used to do it quickly years ago. A little trick to it, over.
Dick, answer it up.
Go ahead, Tony.
On Google, I found partsstore.com. They sell replacement color wheels for all kinds of all makes, and they show you a picture of each different one, makes and models of TV.
It's partsstore.com, color wheels. Interesting. And I know that they do produce a very pure color. Also, when it comes to the decibel discussion, which we had two or three sessions on decibels, a person can go back and listen to those K2KEY discussions by going to the website called amateurradio.tv. AmateurRadio, there's a double R in there, no punctuation between them, amateurradio.tv, and you look up their index for the TechNet, and you can go back to Mel's discussion on DBs and review it that way, so we don't have to go through it again on the air. Let's see now, the subject of how to measure Q, one approach would be to put a capacitor in series with the inductor. And by the way, you want to know the Q at a particular frequency, usually. And the Q is different at different frequencies. X sub L over R is one of the definitions of Q. Inductive reactance divided by the resistance of the coil. So how do you find out the resistance of the coil at the RF frequency? One approach would be to resonate the coil by putting the right capacitor in series with the coil. And make sure the capacitor has got a very high Q to it, so it's not dominating in the circuit, but the only real Q is due to your inductor. Once you've got the L and C in series, and you now measure with a signal generator, what current results from what voltage you apply to that series network. If, for instance, the inductive reactance at that frequency happened to be 1,000 ohms, and you put a good capacitor in series with it and resonated at your favorite frequency, and if now you put 1 volt across that network, the L and the C in series, and you measure the current of 1 ampere, which means that the total series resistance is 1 ohm, and the inductive reactance in order to resonate it was 1,000 ohms, that would be a Q of 1,000. X sub L, inductive reactance divided by resistance. It's a ridiculous example I just did, but that's one approach. I think the Hewlett-Packard Q meter does that. I think it forms a series resonance of your network and measures the current flow through the series resonance with a known amount of voltage applied. They've got a signal generator that's a constant voltage generator, and your meter that goes up and measures Q when you turn the dial that resonates it is really measuring current. That's one approach. I think that's one way of doing it. I wonder how you do it, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, trick from way back from Texas. Measuring Q with simple instruments and everything. We used to have a teacher in the lab there, lab shop, whatever the heck you want. He had a lot of tricks. Some of my tricks, I plagiarized. I didn't come up with these tricks. But basically, stick very close, and that's basically how the Q meters work, basically, that General Radio put out, and a couple of the others. But how I did it, or how I learned to do it, you take the signal generator, you set the generator to the frequency you want to measure the Q of that coil. You then put the a variable capacitor across it, until you see the VTVM. In other words, the generator goes with the capacitor, with the coil, all in parallel, with the VTVM in parallel with it, all in parallel across, in other words, everything's across the generator or across the meter. And you turn the capacitor, the variable capacitor, until the meter peaks. You get a convenient range that just, gives it up to the top of the output of the generating. In other words, sort of the meter, the HCVTVM is now peaked at the top of the scale. You now back off on the generator. You turn the generator dial resonant, and then you go to, record at that frequency. In other words, what it peaked at. Now you turn the signal generator dial through the resonant point to the high frequency point where the meter now drops to 0.707 reading. In other words, you're dropping it back to a 707 reading. You record that frequency. You go back to the resonant frequency. Now you turn the generator to the lower frequency, and you watch it when the DTVM now is indicating 0.707 left on the meter. That is basically what we known as the 3 dB point. Now, you record that. So I just sketched out a quickie now, Dick, an example of frequencies and how to, you know, an actual measurement over.
Okay. There are four definitions of Q. A voltage rise at resonance, current rise at resonance, center frequency divided by 3 dB bandwidth, that's what measure that Mel was just measuring, and the other one is energy stored per cycle over energy dissipated per cycle. To measure that one's more difficult. So let's go back to Mel's technique. He makes a parallel resonance circuit. The variable capacitor, the inductor under measurement, are put in parallel with each other and resonated. The VTVM is assumed to be an extremely high impedance device across the coil and does not load the coil. The catch is now that the signal generator must also be coupled in a way that does not load the coil. If you just had the 50 ohm signal generator and you put it directly across the inductor, it would be a huge load, a 50 ohm load, and you'd be measuring the Q of your inductor with a 50 ohm load, which there's ways you could correct for that, but I think the better approach would be to feed it through an extremely high impedance device, like maybe a 50,000 ohm resistor. So signal generator into a 50K resistor into the parallel LC network, and now the VTVM is only going to measure a small fraction of the voltage that the signal generator is applying, but if it's sensitive enough, no problem. So as long as your LC network is very lightly loaded by both the detector, in this case the VTVM, and very lightly loaded by the signal generator, either by a small coupling capacitor or a high coupling resistor, now you measure the upper 3 dB roll-off frequency, that's where the voltage falls off to 0.707 of the center frequency, and the lower, and you subtract one from the other, the upper from the lower, that's the bandwidth, the 3 dB bandwidth. If the 3 dB bandwidth was 1 megacycle, and if your center frequency is 100 megacycles, 1 divided into 100 would be a Q of 100 in my particular example. So, what was your method of making sure that the signal generator was lightly loading the coil? It can either be doing it as tap down, but the coil might not have a tap, or you're feeding it through a very small coupling capacitor, a high reactive coupling capacitor, or a very high resistor, like a 50K or 100K or a 1 mega ohm resistor. Is that approximately what you did, Mel? K2KEY, K2RIW.
That's it. You used to take a variable resistor, control, carbon control, and just adjust it up to high enough, you know, just so you could get a decent reading, in other words, from the signal generator through this and all by, setting the generator's gain and manipulating the control so that you got, like to say, the highest resistance possible that would deflect the ACVTVM setting over to a convenient, reading at the end of the scale. And then just as Dick said, you use the formula F0 divided by, now I got to remember this, what the teacher remember told me, I would never forget this formula, F0 divided by F2 minus F1. Let me say it again, F0, which is the frequency that you peak at, divided by F2 minus F1. In fact, I just wrote one out. As an example, if FO, if the peak meter, the ACVTVM peaks at, say, 1,000 hertz, while F1, you measure as 980 kilohertz. And F2, the other side, when you go through that peak, you go to the other side with the generator, and it peaks, say, at 1,020 kilohertz. So, now the Q of the coil B, the resonant point, where it peaked was 1,000, divided by F2, which is the 1,020, minus the other reading, which was 980. So it would give us 1,000 divided by 40. In other words, a difference of 40. 1,020 minus 980 is 40. So we got 1,000 as the FO. We're dividing that by 40. So our Q in this particular case would be approximately 25. That's How many years back I remember this thing, over.
Did you first do that at Brooklyn Tech High School, or did you first do that at Pratt Institute? Go ahead.
The Brooklyn Tech job. A lot of these tricks with these formulas and simplifying and all these things, Dick, I'm just plagiarizing them. I remember them because they were so elegant. That's why I, when I worked after school, shopped, and I came up with ways of, you know, fixing things and all. Sure, because I had that training, you know. They these guys didn't learn from the real nitty-gritty like we did tech at the time, really starting with the nitty-gritty. You know, a lot of us came into Brooklyn Tech, you know, as already interested in electronics. And when they sat you down and said, they're going to start with a series circuit, a battery and a bell, or a battery and a light and a switch, you looked and said, are you fooling me, you know? We're really way past that, but no. Our teacher says, you've got to have the foundation. You're going to start digging. We're going to start with you with a shovel digging a foundation. You have to go through that, Dick, all the way through, over.
I thought they had a significant mechanical drawing class, drafting or whatever they called it, mechanical engineering type thing. I bet you also had a foundry class where they had you make sand castings. There was a lot of hands-on things that school taught, didn't it?
WB2HWW with a comment.
Mel first, go ahead, and then pass it over to Howie. You got it, Mel.
Yeah, Roger, we have everything to lose the receiver in a couple of minutes. Yeah, just real quick, but yes, first term you went through a number of different shops and things. Second term you learned some machine shop work, a lot of. All the years you go to Brooklyn Tech, you do take mechanical drawing and freehand drawing and lots of math, 9 terms of math and so on and so far, and like you say, a lot of hands-on stuff. So it was really a phenomenal education I hear now. Bad things were going to happen to that school that's going to close it up, in fact, Dick. So I'll get into that another time. Go ahead, Howie.
Real quick, Dick, at Pratt, when I went there in the 80s, we had to even make our own ICs. We actually went ahead and had to make our own IC in the lab, go around with the IC, and that was a solid state, you know. We did our own etching. And you know, you could take an oscilloscope and look at the phase angle through a resistor, the voltage and the current, and look at the angles, and that can tell you when you're in resonance, when the voltage or current is in series, and when you're at the 45 degree point for 3 dB. 73s, and have a nice week, Dick.
That's another nice lab measurement technique. Okay, you guys have just spent almost 4 hours of your life listening to TechNet number 1173. Of the series that began way back in 1982 in September. Good luck with you all. Be kind to each other, and Mel and I will be back next week trying to do more of the same. Mel, go ahead. You got about a minute and a half. KQLIW.
Okay, Dick says thank you very much for joining us, everybody. Try to get your emails. And all again, I will reemphasize this. I cannot comment, nor will Dick comment, on investment, even though it's in our field. And also, we can't do details of, you know, great magnitude, big details, looking over anybody with their ideas. If you have we're not in that type of business, really, neither one of us. So we're just trying to keep this as a hobby and interesting, so which most people will, you know, on frequency enjoy. 73 is all, as Howie said. Have a great week, everybody. We'll do it again next week, hopefully. This is KQKEY saying goodnight.